Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm with Bo Caldwell, CFP, and Chuck Price, founder and author of Investing Simplified, the book, and the number one bestseller, Your Retirement Made Simple. Chuck Price has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investing in retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America with a financial advisor and now a CFP, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and comes to you live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. You can contact Bo or Chuck by visiting pfgwm.com, or you can email them with a question at ask@pfgwm.com, or you can call them right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. And for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Bo Caldwell.
Good morning and welcome to Investing Simplified. Thanks for making us a part of your day. Thanks for tuning in, whether you're tuning in live on the radio or whether you've downloaded our podcast. For those folks that don't know, we do rebroadcast the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, any place that you get your podcasts on your cellular or mobile device. We'd love if you download. And if you do download, please subscribe and rate our show. We've got a great show today for you. I'd like to call it Investing in Real Estate Simplified today. So if, to that effect, we've invited Michael Standard from Fairway Mortgage Group back to the show to help us out, talk about that. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Bo.
And we've also got Kevin Stege in studio today, the Baker Colson CPA firm. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, gentlemen.
And Chuck is not with us today. He is home today, has the day off today. So we'll try to, you know, power through without him. And as I said, we do have, you know, a great show. We've got some ideas for you about investing in real estate, different ways to invest in real estate, the various tax implications, how to fund that, different ideas like that. But if you do have a question that's been keeping you up at night, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. Also, if you are listening to the show and you have a question, but you don't really feel like coming on the air and asking a question, you can visit investingsimplifiedradio.com and submit your question there, and we'll be able to answer it either there on the site or we can talk about it over the air as well. I don't want you to feel like you can't call in and have your questions answered if you, just because you don't want to come on the air. Well, I wanted to start by talking about the market as we do, you know, each show and where the market has been going. And so far, year to date, the indices that a lot of people look at, and I've talked about it multiple times, that these are just market indices that people use as a proxy for the overall market, but they don't represent the entire market. But the Dow Jones, so far year to date, is up 11.84%. The S&P 500 is up 15.8%, and the NASDAQ has finally come out of its, you know, its slumber and is up 17.5%. So it is outpacing the Dow and the S&P, which we would expect in an up market because those are the companies that are investing more back in their business rather than paying out dividends. A lot of times they are the smaller capitalization companies, and you would hope that if you're investing in those riskier companies, you're getting a better return, you know, a better return for the risk that you're taking. One of the things that's come up for me in the market and in tracking people's portfolios over the last couple of weeks, especially as the market has ticked way up, and then in May when we had this, you know, big down pull, is that people are comparing themselves to a specific market index, and they don't really understand how that index works, particularly the Dow versus the S&P 500. And the difference between those is the way that they're weighted. The Dow is actually price-weighted, and so what that means is if one of the 30 companies that's in the Dow Jones performs a stock split, meaning that they go, you have one share of stock, now you have two, that drives the price in half if they did a two-for-one split. So their price went from $100 a share now to $50 a share, even though there's no real change in the value of that stock. It went from $100 to $50, but you have two shares. So you still have $100 worth of that stock. That can make the index go down. And so people go, well, the index is down even though the market fundamentals are good. Now, the Dow 30, the 30 companies in the Dow, generally aren't doing those all the time, so it's not a big deal that happens all the time, but it's worth noting that that is price-weighted versus the S&P 500, which is market cap-weighted. And what that means is it's weighted based on the capitalization. So you take the number of shares outstanding and you multiply that by the current price, and that's your market capitalization. So companies like Apple and Google, or Alphabet, as Google's parent company is now called, and companies like Amazon make that market move a lot more than smaller companies because there are more shares outstanding, higher price. So now it's market cap weighted. It's just something to keep in mind when you're comparing your performance in your portfolio. Unless you are investing directly in an index fund or an index ETF that seeks to own the companies in that index, you're not going to be tracking right along with it. And I would urge you, when you're meeting with your advisor, when you're reviewing your investment portfolio, try to compare to an index that fits what you're doing. If you have a properly diversified portfolio, a lot of times that's going to include international stocks, international equities, and international bonds. That may include some real estate. That may include some commodities like oil or gold. That may include cash, and probably should include at least a little bit of cash for your opportunities that come up. But if you are investing that way, you're not investing like the S&P 500, which is 100% invested in those 500 biggest companies in the U.S. domestic market. So that means that you're comparing yourself, not apples to apples, but apples to oranges. And in reality, you're going to set yourself up for failure and set yourself up for being disappointed, whether it's in your performance or in the market's performance comparatively, because you're not truly comparing it to an apples to apples comparison. Now, we've had spikes in volatility, especially in May, which is unusual. If we look back historically, volatility has slowed down as we've gotten into May, June, and July, and then really picks up towards the end of the year historically. But this year, it's been a little different, right? We had some big-time volatility at the beginning of the year, which is unusual, and then we had some big-time volatility here back in May. I don't see any way that that doesn't continue. We have continued volatility coming. I don't have a crystal ball to know whether it's going up or down, but I know it's going to do both. And I don't know when that's going to happen, but sometime between now and the end of time, we are going to have what's termed a bear market. Sometime now, between now and the end of time, we're going to have a recession. I don't know if that's tomorrow, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the road, but sometime we're going to have it. And if you don't have a plan for continued market volatility, if you don't have a plan for a bear market and for a recession, then you're going to be in trouble when it happens. Now, the average bear market touches 38% on the downside. Now, we're due. We hit 20% or so intraday in December. So what that means for you, if you are 100% invested in one of those market indices, if you're buying the S&P 500 index fund and going away, then you could have a down pull of 38% that lasts an average of 17, 18 months. So that's a year and a half that you're going to have to ride it out. If you're just subscribing to the buy that index and hold on to it, you're going to have to ride it out for 18 months and possibly 38% down on an average, which means that it may go down more. In 2000, in the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, it went down at something like 52% peak to trough. So it's a 52% loss in your portfolio. And what that means, folks, is if you have $100,000 invested, you now have $48,000. Right? So percentage real dollars. That's a big deal. So you need to have a plan for if that happens. And I wouldn't say just if that happens, when that happens, because from now, between now and the end of time, that's going to happen. So you want to have a plan. If you don't have a plan or you want your plan reviewed, please give my office a call, 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. And myself or Chuck are happy to sit down with you, go over your plan for market volatility and for a bear market, and discuss how we can possibly help you get prepared for that, or tell you, hey, you're doing a great job. And we do that all the time when we don't think we can do any better than what folks are doing. But the worst case is you're going to have had a free second professional opinion to tell you that you're doing a good job. I think that's worth an hour of people's time. I think it's worth sitting down, and you don't have to truck all the way across the river anymore, because Chuck and I now have a West Side office in technically Southwest Portland address, but it's Tigard. We're right there off of 217 and 72nd Avenue. We're happy to meet you there if you're on the west side. And most people are pretty appreciative of just taking some time to sit down. And plus, you got to listen to me rattle on, but you got to listen to me rattle on right now. So really, one of the big ways that people get diversification in their portfolio and want to combat that fluctuation, that volatility in the market, is with real estate. And that's why we are talking about real estate today as an investment product. And there are different ways to get invested in real estate, guys. A lot of times what people hear about are REITs.
Right.
And if people don't know what a REIT stands for, is a real estate investment trust. And Kevin can talk about the tax implications of that, and it can be beneficial to own those. We can talk about how to fund those. The big thing for me, and I get this question a lot, is should I invest in REITs? My advisor's telling me to invest in a REIT. And my first question is, how much is he telling you or she telling you to put in there? Is it publicly traded? And what's the liquidity of it? So those are big questions, because a lot of times if you're investing in publicly traded REITs, you're really not getting as much diversification and less volatility as you think. They behave a lot like stocks. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing to invest in. There's a place for everything. And if that's something you want to own, and the big tagline that people use is, hey, I want to own property without the three T's. I don't like toilets, I don't like trash, and I don't like tenants. I still want to get a real estate investment. And so being able to utilize a REIT or real estate investment trust is a good way if people can't afford to buy the physical property, particularly commercial property, which costs millions of dollars for buildings, right? And it can be a good thing for you, but a big thing that happens is people get those publicly traded REITs and think they're safe, and they act super volatile like stocks. They get a privately traded REIT, and what that means in a privately traded REIT is you cannot get out of it when you want. So you need to be prepared to hold on to that to 7, 8, 9, 10 years as part of your portfolio. And it's going to spit off, you know, the big thing they say is, hey, it pays 7, 8, 9, 10%. And they call it a dividend. It's not a dividend. It's absolutely not a dividend. It's an income payment that's not guaranteed. That's based on the income from those rents that real estate investment trust is getting. They have to pay out 90% of their funds from operations. So the money they make, 90% of it gets paid out to you as the investor, but that could fluctuate because people don't pay their lease, right? We hear about that all the time. Maybe they don't carry as many tenants. And the big thing about those privately traded REITs that, hey, we pay this big number out, but you have to hold on to it for a long time. And what it turns out is a lot of times what they're paying out is actually return of capital. And if you don't know what that means you're not getting actually an income payment. And they say, hey, this is great for tax treatment because it's tax-free income. And what they don't tell you is that actually is lowering your basis in that investment. And so if they're returning your capital, instead of having $10 invested, and when it pays out and says, hey, now it's only worth $11, and you say, well, that doesn't seem like a very good return. They say, oh, but we paid you this income all over the time, and it was tax-free. And then it turns out that your basis isn't $10. Your basis is $5. And so now you have a big capital gain that you weren't planning on.
They gave you your own money back.
Right. Yeah. The return of capital. It's the return of your original investment. So the biggest thing is to be careful with REITs. I have a lot of people asking, now, it doesn't mean it's a bad thing, and it doesn't mean it's not a good investment. The state of Oregon, and a lot of advisors don't know this or don't tell you this, and hopefully their broker-dealer is keeping an eye on it, but you are not allowed to put more than 10% of your liquid net worth in a privately traded REIT. The state of Oregon won't allow it because they don't want you locking up too much of your money, your liquid net worth, the amount of money that you can spend in something that you can't touch or get out of, because a lot of times the only way to get out of it is to sell it at a major loss or a major discount back, because to find somebody else who's going to buy that private placement for you. So that doesn't mean that REITs aren't a good investment. That doesn't mean that real estate isn't a good investment. It can be a really good diversifier. That private placed REIT has a really low correlation with the overall stock market. And correlation means it doesn't track, it doesn't move the same as the overall stock market. And you can also invest in physical real estate. And we're going to talk about the different ways to do that, the different ways to buy that real estate for that rental income, the different ways to pass that real estate to your heirs here in the next couple of segments. But my biggest thing is, don't buy that REIT before talking to us. Get a second opinion, whether that's me as a second opinion or another advisor. Go check it out. Have it looked at, because a REIT can be a good investment for the right person, for the right investor who goes into it with the right mindset and looks at it the right way. Because just because something pays a really big yield or a really big income payment doesn't mean it's a good thing. Michael, if somebody comes to you and tries to get a mortgage and you say, okay, so Kevin and I apply for the same mortgage and you tell Kevin, hey, well, I can get you 3% on your 30-year mortgage, but Bo, it's going to be about 6.5%. What's the big reason behind that? It's
rating. We're right. Looking at your debt-to-income ratio and your credit score and other assets you may have or may not have.
So that to me means I'm a bigger risk.
Correct.
Right? So in order for you guys to give me that money, to loan me that money to buy that piece of property, I have to pay a higher interest rate for it to make sense for you guys to loan that money, right? Because I'm a higher risk.
Correct.
So you can think about that in the same way when you're talking about yield investments or things that are yielding higher income. To me, that's a red flag if somebody says, hey, this pays 12% interest or it pays 12% on a dividend on this REIT. To me, that means it's way higher risk because they have to compensate me for that risk with that bigger return. So just making sure that people know that that's a big reason that they're paying out higher dividends and higher income. Now, the REITs, Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that REITs, most of the time, those private place REITs still get that 20% pass-through income treatment, right?
The deduction, yes.
Right. So that's so that's a big thing if you're in a taxable account to have a REIT in there, but a great way to actually combat that income and not have to worry about when you can get your money out because you control it is to invest in property, invest in physical property, which we have a lot of people ask about. And I want to talk about the implications of that. When we come back from break, we're going to talk about a way to organize yourself to make sure that the tax implications on that when you pass away are taken care of. And we're going to talk a little bit about how to get into that. A lot of people are wondering, and I get questions a lot of times, how do I fund this? How do I look at buying an investment property, buying my first investment property? What are the implications of lending to a family LLC or lending to a group of folks? Because those are ways that you can get into investing in your property. And a lot of times people don't realize, but as a retirement plan, having multiple properties can be a really good thing if you have steady income coming from them, if you have levers to pull, so that way if you do need extra funds, hey, we can always sell that investment property if it's paid off or even if it has a little bit of a mortgage on it. And so we want to make sure that people have diversified streams of income because I don't know how long Social Security is going to last. Probably not going to last for me. You guys might get some, right? But I don't know. We'll have to see how that goes, right? But I don't want people to feel like they don't have diversified streams of income, right? And so the only thing is you're going to have to deal with those three T's, though. And tenants, trash, and toilets can be a pain. So we're going to take a quick break here, and we'll come back afterwards with the tax investigator segment. Kevin's going to talk a little bit more what we teased last week about how to pass that real estate via a family LLC to try and not pay more estate tax than we have to pay. So if you'd like to learn about that, stay with us. We'll be back on the other side of the break. Thank you for listening to Investing Simplified.
We do Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Colson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin, 503-417-9595, or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we do want your calls. The phones have been quiet this morning as there's just been so much good information to assimilate. We're all just percolating over that right. And thinking about it. But 503-417-9595, any question that you have on real estate, investing, taxes, we'll be glad to take that here this morning, even if it's off topic. And then our toll-free number is 877-733-1011. So today on the Tax Investigator, we're going to talk a little bit about estate tax in Oregon and Washington, and particularly real estate in Oregon and Washington, and how LLCs can factor into that and help or hurt maybe your estate tax situation. So in general, we're going to use some examples here, and I'm just going to give some real basic ground rules and frameworks so that we know what we're all we're talking the same apples to apples. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna have a theoretical Oregon resident. And this resident, very simple, single person or maybe the last to die, their full estate is $2 million. And as we all know, Oregon has a $1 million threshold for filing Oregon estate taxes and paying taxes. So if you have a $2 million estate and you pass away, your first million is exempt and the second million is taxable. And roughly, you're going to be subject to about a 10% rate. I don't think you're moving up into the 11% bracket. So we're talking $100,000 tax. Now, this theoretical Oregon resident has, we'll say, a $1.8 million of invested assets with Bo, and he's mm-hmm. doing very well with that because you only put $100,000 in, and now it's worth $1.8 million.
Right, because so, I'm amazing.
Exactly. Yes. Absolutely. So that part's done well. Your other part of your state is a $200,000 lot over in Central Oregon. You bought into a resort there, and it's an investment property, and it's just a nice piece of land, but you haven't done anything with it. Maybe Sun River, maybe one of those resorts over there. So as we discussed, that would be about $100,000 when you pass away on your full estate because you're an Oregon resident. And let's say you have decided to hop the river. Mm. Now, you have moved over into Washington, and you still have the $200,000 lot in Oregon, and you've got your brokerage account with Bo. Common misconception is, well, my Oregon estate is now under $1 million. I don't have to file an Oregon return. And that's incorrect. Your gross estate is still $2 million. You have Oregon real property of $200,000, which is one-tenth mm-hmm. of your estate. And so and your tax bill was $100,000. So now your tax bill is one-tenth of that. It's $10,000. So you would file, as a Washington resident who owns Oregon real property, you'd file an Oregon estate, an OR 706 estate tax return and pay $10,000. You would not file a Washington because Washington's amount is estate amount is 2.1 or 2.2, or I think it goes up for inflation every year, so it's tweaked up a bit. So that's how that would work. But what about, let's go back to our first example. Mm-hmm. You're an Oregon resident, and what about if you have an LLC? So, and this LLC, the sole purpose is for holding this real property. So you've got your lot and you've titled it from your name into the LLC, the family LLC, if you will, and you pass away. Well, everything's the same in Oregon. It's still Oregon LLC interest. It's still $1.8 million in your brokerage account, and you still owe the $100,000. Same scenario. You move over to Washington. You've got your $1.8 million, and now you are an owner of intangible LLC units in Washington, and that LLC happens to own real property in Oregon. That property is not subject to Oregon inheritance tax because you actually own the units, similar to if you owned Microsoft stock. You don't actually own property up in Seattle and all that stuff. You just own stock certificates that are worth something.
Right.
So that's typically how the LLC scenario works. In this case, you'd save the $100,000, but you could see if this $2 million estate, say you had half of your estate was three rentals in Oregon,
right,
and Bo only had maybe $1 million of your assets and another $1 million was in real estate. Well, you put these pieces of real estate in an LLC, and now you can see there's significant tax savings on the $1 million you get that out of Oregon. So in general, that's how the LLC works. Now let's reverse the scenario a little bit. Say you're a Washington resident, and you have you're creating this LLC in other states, basically to try to skirt the I guess in this scenario, this would be as if you had Washington property. Washington's going to tax that same property. So you're an Oregon resident. You own Washington property. You put in an LLC. Washington has a little caveat. They have a little asterisk by this whole LLC plan. And that is you have to have a true, quote, true business purpose for creating this LLC. What's a true business purpose? Is it investing a true business purpose, holding investment property, or is it an active trader business? And so they're going to play a little bit more hardball on you and basically say, no, you created this LLC to skirt the Washington estate tax limits. You don't have a proper operating business. I would think if you had rentals,
right,
that probably qualifies. But if it's maybe a bare lot...
Right, or if it's my vacation property in Sun River, like you said.
That's right. That's right.
I don't have one of those, but it'd be nice.
Theoretically.
So if you're giving them away, you let me know.
That's right. That's right. So in general, that's kind of how the LLC game works. You've created you've transferred real property into intangible LLC units, and it's taxed where the decedent dies, not where the property is sited.
So that's big for, you know, to have clients that do that a lot, because we've talked about just moving across the river. I mean, Michael, you're over in Vancouver, right?
Right. And yes,
it's a much better place to pass away or to retire to a lot of times if you're not in no state income tax, let alone that much higher estate tax limit. But folks will have rental properties that maybe they bought over here, or vacation properties. You know, they have a property out at the coast or over in Sun River, or maybe down south on the Rogue or something like that, where they have these vacation properties that maybe aren't business purposes. But in your scenario, we're not trying to not pay on Washington property, trying to not pay on Oregon property. So that might be huge. You talked about if that's 50 or 60% of your estate that gets over that, which a lot of times when people own a lot of property, it's a big part of it. That could save you a lot of money.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, Michael, you had a few questions in regards to, like, of the LLCs, who is the member manager, or maybe when you pass away, who's going to be the beneficiary.
Right.
And typically those don't factor into where the property is going to be taxed. Those rules are kind of set, as I previously described. But depending on what sort of business operation you have in your LLC, if there's rentals going, if it's a family, they call them family limited partnerships, the IRS is cracking down a bit on discounts that are applied to the valuation of those units. The scenario typically is you make the kids the managing partners, they own the majority of the company, you own less, because you have a minority interest, and you can't force liquidity, you can't force a sale, you can't get your money out so easy, then there's supposedly a discount that you can apply to your estate when you pass away. A really aggressive percent would be 40% discount. Typically, 20% was kind of a no-brainer amount, and then depending on how aggressive you needed your tax planning to be, you found some sort of valuation in between there. But they're really kind of cracking down on that game, and frankly, they, you know, that's kind of a bit of a shell game, if you ask me. But it has worked, and it does work. I would be pretty careful about that anymore. And in fact, they may have curtail that even more. And that's usually for a pretty going concern, a pretty pretty active family trader business. But investing in real property. I mean, that's what some people do, and right. it's definitely a going concern. So,
okay, that makes sense. And so you can't. That's what we were kind of Michael and I were kicking around that idea. How do we? It's not skirting the taxes, are trying to avoid them, but just not paying more than my fair share. We've talked about that a lot. So if someone has rentals, it makes sense to have a family LLC, but from what you're saying, it sounds like it may not make as much sense to be trying to transfer that during life, or?
Well, for discount purposes, right. I would definitely have a plan laid out and have something looked at there. But I think it's almost a no-brainer to put rentals and real property in an LLC but you want it to meet your set of circumstances and stuff. But at least from a limited liability standpoint, especially if it's a rental, one single family residence, maybe that's not such a big deal, but why not? It's an extra level of insurance and protection, legal protection, which of course we don't give legal advice without our attorney here.
Right. Yeah. She's not here right now, so we can't give that.
That's right.
Yeah, that's the caveat.
I think it should be done. It's a pretty easy setup with the Secretary of State, extra level of protection. Usually you can, you don't have to file a tax return.
That was going to be my other question.
Yeah, for something like that, unless you set it up with a partner or something. So it's usually a good way to go. So another item regarding Oregon estate taxes, and I think this is kind of key, is the $1 million that Oregon has, the first $1 million exemption. Number one, it's not adjusted for inflation. So that's something to consider. There's becoming more and more millionaires, if you will. I think there's a online fad of your 401k millionaires, who can reach $1 million in your 401k and stuff.
It's interesting.
Kind of a weird thing, if you ask me.
But it's better than the Tide Pod Challenge.
This is true. This is true.
If it's a challenge just to save more money, I think I'm on board.
Exactly. Exactly. But with Oregon, you don't get to port that exemption to your spouse. So you do need to, if you have a combined estate with your husband and wife over $1 million, you typically are going to need some sort of estate plan so that there is no estate tax when the second of you passes away. Typically what's done to preserve the $1 million exemption for the first to die is some form of trust is set up.
Right.
They call it the AB trust or the credit shelter trust. You put the $1 million subject to estate taxes to the first spouse to die, put it in the trust. That is not, it got the stepped up basis. It is now not part of the surviving spouse's estate, and they can use the money. They get the income. It's basically under their control because they're the trustee of that trust. But it does escape a second Oregon taxation. Of course, you don't get the stepped up basis on that property then when the second dies.
Right.
But that's how the game is played.
Right. It can be. That's the key. Is there that my key takeaway from that is you need to speak to your CPA and an estate attorney when you're getting that plan, that credit shelter trust or the AB. I've heard it called portability trust, all the different names. But getting that in place so that way you don't have to pay that extra, inheritance tax, right? You don't have to pay the estate tax.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't know, but your life insurance proceeds are part of that gross estate. And if you have cash value life insurance or any of the life insurance proceeds, and a lot of times people don't realize it's real easy to get into that space. If you're in your earning years, your high earning years still, and you have a term insurance policy that you went out and bought because it's super cheap and it's $1 million or $1.5 million, you're already over the $1 million estate, the estate.
That's right.
So if you don't realize that part of it, that's something to be talking to an attorney about. And we talk about it all the time, the difference between getting yourself set up with a trust or just having a will done, and the difference between spending a couple $1,000s on a trust or your heirs having to spend $30,000-$40,000 in probate is huge.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then that's not even including just once they tell you how much is actually in the estate and here's how much tax you owe. But just to be able to take that small amount of money and set it aside is not a bad plan.
That's right. And, you know, another part of an estate plan is, as you mentioned, the life insurance. That's not a bad way if you've got money tied up in real estate and various places, your home and your IRA and such. Investing in some life insurance, and I'm not peddling any product. I don't know anything about that type of stuff. I leave that to you guys, Bo. But that is not a bad way to basically have a provision for your estate tax bill and know that you've just provided liquidity for your heirs to basically pay your estate taxes, keep your assets, you know, whatever plan you have there. And, you know, sometimes people look at the estate tax as like, oh, it's terrible, I'm subject to estate tax. It's only 10 to 16% in Oregon. To hit that 16%, you have to have over $10 million or 11, somewhere around there. So roughly 10, 11, 12% on life insurance, not subject to income taxes.
Right.
Providing liquidity for your estate to pay inheritance taxes, not a bad scenario. I think more people should look at that. And I've seen those life insurance trusts. It doesn't even have to be that complex.
Right.
It can just be a life insurance policy. But I've seen those work very well.
Yeah, even if you, especially we're talking about people that have a lot of money, a lot of their estate is in illiquid property, right? So then your estate doesn't have to try and sell the house. And what if we're in a, you know, a downturn in the housing market, or prices just aren't as good as you'd like it when you sell, or maybe there's a lot of inventory out there and you're not going to get top dollar for it. Why force your estate or your heirs to sell it unless they want to?
Yeah,
could be a real good option. And like you said, we're not peddling specific products, but if you'd like to talk about those kind of options and see if they might be a fit, give our office a call, 503-253-3000, or send me an email at bo@pfgwm.com, or send it to our general mailbox at ask@pfgwm.com. So we're going to take another quick break here, and then I want to come back and give Michael a little bit of room to run here on talking about how to get invested in those properties, how to get the funding for that, and different ways that we can make that happen for you if that's something you're looking to do. I also like to give him a chance to shout out his contact information, but I'm going to do it right now. If you want to get in touch with Michael specifically, his direct number is 360-690-5278. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, back to Bo Caldwell.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified. However you're listening today, thanks for sticking with us. Thank you for listening on your various devices or on the live radio show. We have some more content to talk to you about, how to get invested in real estate if that's something you're looking to do, how to turn that into some income, how to maybe save some money on taxes while we're getting that income. But if you have a question, and even if it doesn't have anything to do with real estate investing or the tax implications of real estate, if you have a question for Michael about your mortgage or different funding levels, give us a call, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. Michael, we were just talking in the break about your experience with utilizing, you know, rental properties or properties out there to generate some income and how it's really worked out well for you.
Yeah, there's a certain tax benefit for all of your repairs and for maintenance. And that seems to be what a lot of people get into real estate for, plus the income that they receive off of the property. What do you think about that, Kevin?
Yes. And yes. I typically, when I'm planning a rental, I typically consider it to be pretty well tax neutral, unless it's a cash cow. Maybe it's a commercial rental. Typically, we see real positive cash flow on that, and that's kind of a different scenario. But your single family residences, maybe your duplexes, you know, you might pull in $24,000, but you've got your mortgage payments and you've got your repair and maintenance. Typically, we're looking at neutral cash flow, and you know, sometimes if you produce a if you're in a high enough income bracket, if you produce a loss, they start limiting that loss and suspend it. You don't lose it, but it gets suspended.
Defer it.
So it really depends. But I think, you know, the key thing to a rental is the underlying piece of real property. That's the real benefit. Is this in a good location? Is it growing in value? Bought it for, you know, $200,000, put $50,000 in, and now it's worth $500,000. Who cares? You know, if cash neutral during your ownership period, fine. But now you just made $250,000. That's pretty good. So
yeah. And generally, just to purchase a rental property, the general rule of thumb is you can purchase up to a fourplex. If you go over four units, then it's a commercial property.
Oh, interesting.
And you have to get a commercial loan. Also, you have to put 20% to 25% down. Generally, there are some lenders who will let you take and put less down. But of course, the rates are going to be higher. But generally, you can purchase a rental property and use it and produce and pull back in the income. We also look at the income that it's going to be generating if it has existing renters. They'll use that as part of your factor to give you how much money you need to put down, what your loan rate will be.
Interesting. So it might be better to, or not better necessarily, better is the wrong term, but it might be easier. It eases the funding requirements if it has existing tenants or long-term tenants in the in the property.
It does. The other thing is, if you're purchasing it in an LLC, there are lenders out there who will do that. Generally, it's not easy, and they're specialized lenders. Most people purchase through Fannie Mae as a sole individual or as a couple. Then they transfer it, retitle it into their LLC. Oh, they have to go pay title again. But it's a benefit to them to look at both ways and see what's going to be the best rate for them, because it all comes down to cash flow on your doors. And I know a lot of old salty investors, and their rule of thumb is if you're not making $200 a door, you're not going to be working this property very well.
Interesting.
So something you need to think about too. And on the commercial property side, that's a great investment, very difficult to find as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there are commercial lenders out there that I can put you in touch with who can help you finance those properties.
Perfect. So we actually, and I hate to interrupt because those are it's an interesting concept, but we have a call on the line. Don has a question about life insurance. Go ahead, Don. Good morning.
Good morning. Been a listener about 3 years now, and I'm listening to you right now. And I had a question about life insurance. My wife recently passed away. And I have a $200,000 policy, and I'm either going to cash it in or sell it. And I talked to one of the companies that buy your insurance. I have not completed that. I just wanted to see if you folks have any idea or any input on which might work best. Are there taxes involved when I sell a life insurance policy?
So when you say sell the policy, was this – and first of all, sorry for your loss.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, so was the policy on your late wife's life, or is it on your life?
My life. So I have a cash value of about 56 right now. And when you sell it, they'll itemize it out and find out what the best course is and how much longer I have to live, whether it benefits them. They may give me, 35, 44, or who knows, 80,000. I have no idea, but sure. I just wondered if you guys had ever heard of it or had any dealings with that.
So I have had some dealings with the selling of the life insurance. Have you, let me ask you, have you explored just surrendering the policy for the $56,000?
Have I done that or thought about it?
Explored it, yeah, thought about it, yeah. Just because instead
explored,
of
having, yeah.
Yeah. So, because if they will buy it for more than the $56K, but I wouldn't, just from first blush, there's no way that I would let them buy it for less than that, because you can, what the cash value means, right, is you can surrender it for that cash value. You can take your 56K.
Exactly.
But let me ask you the bigger question is, what is the insurance for? What was the plan was, in case you passed away, it was just giving some income to your wife, or are we thinking about leaving it as a legacy?
Exactly. Because when I pass away, my retirement goes down three quarters.
Right. You had a pension plan. That makes sense to me. Yeah. So, and is there any thought? Are you still paying premiums on the policy right now?
Monthly premiums for a while longer. I think till I'm 85. I'm 77 now.
Okay. So, and that's in that, so that we'd be able to. So, the benefit of selling it or surrendering it is we can get rid of those premiums and get your money back out. The tax implication on the life insurance is going to be the amount that you've put in, the amount that you've paid in, any amount over that amount that you've paid in, if you receive that, that's income, right? And I believe it's not capital gain. I believe it's ordinary income. I can verify that for you. But so if, hypothetically, you've got $56,000 in cash value and you've paid $40,000 in premiums, if you got $56,000 out, you'd have $16,000 worth of income that's recognized. Same thing if they bought it from you for more than that. I don't know if the difference there between the cash value and what they paid for it, if they pay a premium, I don't know if that difference is capital gain or ordinary income. We'd have to find out. But either way, you're going to have to pay taxes on if you make money on it. Alternatively, if you've put in $60,000 and it's only worth $56,000, if you were to take that $56K out, it would be similar to what we talked about with the real estate investments. That's just your money back. So, so if they're willing to buy it for more than the $56K, I don't know, without knowing the situation, I don't want to tell you exactly what to do, but that, other than knowing what the tax implications for that would be, you have to pay tax on it. I just don't know if it's ordinary income or cap gain, but if they're trying to get it from you for less than $56, I'd tell them to go pound sand and just call the insurance company and surrender it.
Right. Very well.
Sounds like all ordinary.
Thank you so much.
Sounds like all ordinary income to me.
Yeah? Yeah. Okay. So probably ordinary income. So that's another thing to weigh in there as well, as if that's going to bump you into the next bracket based on your pension income and those sort of things.
Right. All okay. right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for listening, Don. Thanks for the call, and sorry again about your loss. You have a great day.
Thank you very much.
All right. So that's a great question about, you know, life insurance and about cash value. A lot of people get into that. I haven't dealt with a whole lot of the viatical settlements and the buying of life insurance. It generally, to me, it seems like it's not the worst thing ever if they're going to willing to give him more than $56K and they get a $200,000 benefit. They're paying the premiums. That's kind of how they look at it. So basically, I don't know how they get past the having a verifiable. I think it's because they don't have an insurable interest in him, but I think it's a whole thing.
Interesting.
It's a whole thing. But
very good.
Yeah, so we were talking about getting funding for commercial loans. If folks have questions about wanting to buy into a commercial property, what occurs to me, Michael, is in terms of if people, Kevin mentioned it briefly earlier, but if you have a partner, or if you have, maybe it's not a family LLC, but maybe you've got a business partner, that, you know, a lot of folks, I have, you know, I do have clients that have, you know, they buy, it's commercial because it's more than four units. And, you know, there may be, our West Side office is rented from, you know, a couple of guys who are business professionals who on the side own a couple of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of getting a funding for that, what are the sort of hoops that people have to jump through? Or
rule of thumb is it's 40% down.
Okay.
And then the commercial lender will give you similar rates, and they're going to be a little bit higher than general rates on non-commercial loans. So I can walk them through if they have questions, and I can send them to lenders who can do that. I do not do commercial loans.
Okay.
But I can help direct them to people who do a good job with them. And by the way, my NMLS number is 1674259. And I wanted to mention something else for the seniors who are listening. If you want to have a home snowbird, and potentially it's could be a rental property or duplex that you live in, let's say, Las Vegas, you can purchase them with a HECM, home equity conversion mortgage. So you can put 50 to 60% down and live in that property without having to pay a mortgage. So you'd be collecting all the rents. But you have to live in it at least 6 months out of the year. that has to be your primary residence. But it's a great opportunity for seniors to look into as well.
So in looking into, in that situation, that's utilizing, just to reiterate, utilizing the HECM is not on their current, so let's say, hypothetically, we've got, you know, a Vancouver resident who doesn't, you know, she doesn't like the winters up here anymore, and so, you know, wants to move, wants to spend 6 months out of the year in Vegas, or we're an investing show. Let's talk about Phoenix instead of Vegas,
right?
But someplace warm, you know, Palm Desert,
right?
And they want to utilize the HECM. They're utilizing the HECM on this investment or vacation property. Essentially, right. It's a primary residence.
Becomes their primary residence
because they have to live there. But if they did, like what you talked about, the thing that pinged my interest was you buy a duplex down there and rent out the other side.
Correct. So you're generating income. You're not paying a mortgage payment. So it gives you some advantages over a regular mortgage.
Or hypothetically, and this maybe
because it's cash flow.
Right. No, it's huge. Then you're putting 50% down and you don't have to spend anything. You don't have to spend any mortgage payments. You don't have to cover those with rent. So if somebody was doing that with, like, does it matter about that? They have to live there 6 months out of the year. But could they Airbnb it out or do something like that at the short term rentals whilst they're not there? Or it has to be a duplex situation.
It would have to be a duplex situation.
Okay.
Yeah. But you can look at that with your tax advisor as well. I can't give tax advice. I can give HECM advice, home equity conversion mortgage advice. But it's a great opportunity for seniors to leverage. But again, it becomes their primary residence. So they're going to be a California resident.
Oh, sure, sure.
Okay, so taxes are going to be different. That's where you need to talk to your CPA.
That makes a lot of sense.
That's why Las Vegas, because Nevada doesn't have an income tax.
Right, yeah. So, all right, fine. We're going to Las Vegas.
All right.
Nevada's very nice place to be,
right?
Tax-wise.
What's the difference between spread in interest rates between commercial and residential right now?
Commercial is going to be 1% higher.
A whole percent, okay.
Yep, at least. And a residential property, so if you're buying a unit here that's not commercial and you're renting it out, you're going to pay 0.5% to maybe even 1% more. Their rates are just higher.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's just in general higher than a primary residence purchase, right?
Yep, correct.
It makes sense.
I guess they figure somebody's more willing to protect their principal residence and make the payments. And,
right,
okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep, higher risk in rentals because you have damages and all that other fun stuff.
Yeah. Which, that's the three T's again,
mm-hmm.
right? The toilets, trash, and tenants.
Yeah.
Got to deal with that.
You know, one question we get a lot right now is the 20% deduction that you alluded to. How does that apply to real estate? And in general, the IRS finally came up with some pretty good guidance. If you just have one or two single family residences, you probably aren't going to get that 20% deduction. But not a big loss, because typically you're looking at expenses.
Relatively neutral cash flow.
Yeah, exactly. You're not showing a ton of income from those. But if you're a real estate professional or you have significant rentals that you're spending 750 hours or more in a year managing these, then absolutely that 20% deduction will apply. So kind of the facts and circumstances need to kind of structure your story, if you will, or maybe make your story fit the rules and get that 20% deduction, and it will help if you're showing income. So
that'd be great.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah. And just a small caveat. Triple net leases. So even if you have a commercial real estate, piece of commercial real estate, and it's showing a positive cash flow, if it's a triple net lease, you don't qualify, because they figure you are not an active trader business. This tenant is.
Right.
You're just an investor.
What does triple net lease mean?
Oh, that means the tenant's going to pay. You know this stuff.
Just ask him.
All right. The tenant's going to pay what? Insurance, property taxes, and maintenance?
And rent, too.
Okay. Right, yeah. Oh, they pay, I would assume they pay the utilities part of that as well, right?
Yeah.
So
they maintain the property for you as well.
Ooh, good times.
Yeah.
That's why they don't give you the 20% deduction, because the tenant's doing all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And say you have five commercial residences, and you're really involved in all of this to some degree, but you hire a management company and they're doing really all the management. That's what I meant to say. You're not so involved. You have a lot of properties, but somebody else is doing the managing. You're probably not putting the 750 hours in. So anyway, that's that.
No, that makes sense. I mean, reasons to do it, reasons not to. So if you have questions for Michael and you want to call about funding, commercial lending, or he doesn't do that, but he'll refer you to people he trusts, give his office a call, 360-690-5278. You can reach him at michael.standard@fairwaymc.com. Kevin, if people have tax questions, they want to give you a call, how do they get a hold of you?
Baker-Colson.com, 503-666-5569.
Perfect. And you can give Chuck or I a call, 503-253-3000. We have offices on the east side and west side of Portland. We love to hear from you. Thanks for listening this week. We'll be back next week with Investing Simplified. God bless you out there. Have a great day.
Navigating through today's financial investment world can seem pretty scary. Now, here's the good news. Chuck Price, president of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, introduces a new revolutionary concept that will change how you invest now and in the future. It's called Asset Lock. Asset Lock monitors your investment accounts 24/7, 365, and alerts you when action needs to be taken. And now, Chuck Price offers Asset Lock. At Price Financial Group Wealth Management, we believe all our clients deserve to have Asset Lock monitoring their accounts. So call Chuck today or online at pfgwm.com and learn how you can get Asset Lock on your accounts today for free. Price Financial Group Wealth Management, because the smart investor knows what you don't know can hurt you.
Simplify.
Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000 or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.